From KUOW in Seattle, welcome to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. On February 23rd, 2022, Ukrainians went to bed in a country on the brink. For months, Russian military forces were stationed near the border, encircling Ukraine on three sides. The U.S. intelligence community told the world to brace for an invasion, but many observers questioned if war was in Vladimir Putin's plans. The worst-case scenario was confirmed the next morning.
Good evening, and we're coming on the air at this hour with breaking news after the U.S. warned all day of a full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine that it was imminent. Vladimir Putin has just addressed the Russian people moments ago, announcing what Putin called the start of a military special operation, in his words.
As President Putin spoke, before dawn, big explosions were heard on the outskirts of Kiev, Kharkiv, Odessa, and other cities across Ukraine.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky issuing a video statement overnight declaring martial law, urging Ukrainians to stay home and not panic, adding, quote, "We are strong."
Friday marks 1 year since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and we're going to take you to a city near the front lines right now to hear from David Tagliani. He's a Seattleite volunteering on the ground in Ukraine with the aid organization Stay Safe UA. Lately, his work involves bringing internet access to civilians affected by the war. We first spoke to David in January when he was home in Queen Anne for a holiday break, and he's been back in Ukraine for a little over a month now. David zoomed in for our interview from a house on the outskirts of Slovyansk, a city in the eastern Donetsk region. It's about 20 miles west of Bakhmut, the site of a months-long brutal Russian siege. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said in December that Bakhmut had been reduced to burned ruins by constant shelling. But so far, Ukrainian opposition has been able to hold Russian forces back.
There have been artillery attacks, even here in Slovansk, a couple times a day. It's kind of a constant thing. It's sort of like thunder in the background. You hear this rumbling going on, and you just kind of get used to it. You sort of put it out of your mind. So that's happening right now, as a matter of fact.
David took us back to the early days of the invasion, when Stay Safe UA was formed to help refugees crossing the border to Poland.
Hundreds of thousands of refugees were pouring out of Ukraine into Poland at that time. And it was very cold, and a lot of people were getting hypothermia. People were dying on the border. I came in March, so the conflict had been going on for about 3 or 4 weeks when I got here. We were providing food and medical care. I'm an EMT, so was our function, was to try to treat injuries, hypothermia, do what we could to facilitate refugees moving over the border. And at that time, it was quite amazing because the border guards were basically just shoving people through. You know, it's like, as fast as you can, move, move, move. They were barely checking documents. And if you didn't have documents, they were still letting people go. So I have to hand it to the Poles and to the Ukrainian border guards that they really helped facilitate. But of course, it was a probably 5 or 10 people wide line that was probably more than a mile long of people trying to get across the border at that point. And, you know, 6 inches, 8 inches of snow. Men are not allowed to leave the country. So they would arrive in their vehicles, basically let their wives and children out at the end of this long line, and then turn around and head back, not knowing, you know, whether their wives and children were able to make it across the border, if they were okay, where they were going to end up going. I mean, complete, utter chaos. So even though the border guards were doing what they could to facilitate people moving through the border, it's such a huge volume of people trying to get across the border that there was just no way that they could move any faster. So as a result, there were some deaths, and a number of people died of hypothermia, that kind of thing, on the border. But generally speaking, it was, given that there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of refugees moving, it's quite amazing that they were able to get people on buses and trains and move further to the west into Poland and Germany and Denmark, and the rest of Europe really stood up and took these refugees in. Yeah, so it's a humanitarian disaster of, you know, epic proportions.
Yeah, and almost a year later,
How has Ukrainian daily life changed? I mean, what is it like to live in a city that's in the eastern part of the country that has the experience like you're having right now of hearing daily shelling? How do people go about their day-to-day lives?
Yeah, it's a very interesting situation. I'm a humanitarian aid worker, so I do this a lot. I've been doing it since the end of the 1990s. So I've been to many, many, many disasters around the world. You know, the Indonesian tsunami in 2005 and Haiti earthquake and Hurricane Michael that was in 2016. So I've been to this sort of situation a lot. What is so strange about the situation is it's this ongoing disaster. Every single day, it's like the disaster recreates itself and draws more people in. Whereas in every other disaster scenario that I've been in, the situation gets better as time goes by, of course, because it's a hurricane or an earthquake. Whereas this is just ongoing and in many ways is worse. People still have to live their lives. You know, there's this disaster is happening, but you still have to get your kids to school and go to the store and go shopping and get your food for the day, that kind of thing. So in many ways, people have been able to compartmentalize the disaster aspects of what's going on here with the daily life aspects. And it's been very interesting to see, because if you take the country, it's kind of divided down the center. The Dnipro River runs basically from Kyiv all the way down to the Black Sea. So it's divided into the eastern part and the western part. And in the western part, after, say, April, when the Russians had been pushed out generally from that area and pushed out from Kyiv and that sort of thing, life started to return to something sort of approaching normal. They would get the occasional missile strike or the occasional artillery attack that would happen across the border. But generally speaking, on a day-to-day basis, you know, you were living in your apartment. Many refugees had moved back by that point, so their lives were starting to return to normal. But in the East, it's completely different. It's like it's an honest-to-God full-on war zone. And we were in Siversk yesterday. There's a hospital there that we are supporting. The Ukrainian government about 3 months ago came up with this plan to say, we're going to build these things that are called unbreakable points. And so they're in every major city, even many villages. And basically the idea is that this is going to be a location that people can come to get a cup of tea, maybe some soup, warm up. There'll be a wood-burning stove or something like that in order to keep people warm. It's really a smart decision on their part, because what it allows people to do is basically take a break from sort of the onslaught, gather in a location that's warm where they can get something to eat and maybe get a blanket and meet with their neighbors, because there's no electricity, there's no running water, there's no power, no gas. So people are living in their apartments day to day. It's dark. They may have to heat their food out in the courtyard of their apartment. But generally speaking, people are not interacting a lot. You know, you cook your meal and you go back to your apartment or whatever. So this gives people a safe place that's warm and dry and allows them to interact. And so it's a really great idea. And so what we're doing is working with the Ukrainian government to establish maybe internet access in these locations, set up generators so that people can recharge their phones, because many people have phones, but without power, there's nothing that they can do. There's no cell phone network. Of course, there's no electricity, so there's no cell phone network as well. So this allows people to charge their phones, first of all, and then with some sort of satellite access, allow them to get internet. So people then can say, I've arrived in at the, you know, Siversk hospital unbreakable point, call their families and say, we made it. We're not in Bakhmut anymore. Bakhmut is now a closed city. The military has basically said, if you're here, evacuate, but we're not letting anybody else in other than the military. So people are, you know, leaving Bakhmut, and the next sort of natural town to go to would be Siversk or Slovyansk or Kramatorsk. And so these unbreakable points are allowing people to move to those locations and then get maybe a bed and a hot meal. And now they'll be able to get internet access and power so that they can charge their phones and call their families and let them know that they're okay.
Yeah, that's huge.
That's our main project right now that we're working on. In fact, that's what we're doing right here as well.
Some of the photos that you sent involve fortifications that have been built into the ground in between Bakhmut and Kramatorsk, which you mentioned in your email would be the next logical point if Russia were to take Bakhmut, moving on to the next biggest city, Kramatorsk. But there are, like you sent to us, these trenches, basically, and fortifications, fortified bunkers in between Bakhmut and Kramatorsk. I mean, seeing these images, it's like something out of World War I. I don't know if folks can really process outside of Ukraine the level of ground, foot-by-foot warfare that's going on. Can you kind of explain to people what that actually looks like when you're in Ukraine?
Yeah, it's you do become kind of inured to it in that, you know, you see these fortifications everywhere. So it's sort of like you start editing them out of your vision because they literally are everywhere. Bakhmut was a city of probably 50,000 people before the war. So, you know, pretty good size, but relatively small. The Russians have been trying to take this town for 6-8 months now. And make just these small incremental gains. You know, they'll close one area, but then lose another area. So it's just been this kind of trench, like you're saying, it's like World War I trench warfare, where the combatants are in literal visual range of each other. They can see each other as they're shooting back and forth. Artillery shells are going overhead back and forth. The thing is, though, that the Ukrainians are on their own territory, so their supply lines are very short. They can basically, within 5 or 10 miles, go to a location where they can pick up more supplies, food, all of that kind of stuff, whereas the Russians are on Ukrainian territory, so they have a much further distance to go in order to bring supplies to their front lines. As a consequence, they're people are running out. They're running out of artillery. They're running out of ammunition. They don't have sufficient warm clothing for the winter, that sort of thing. So they have just a much bigger logistical problem regarding getting supplies to their frontline troops. On top of everything else, the Ukrainians have managed to keep their entire railway system up and running. So they can get supplies in Poland. And within a day, they can have a train arriving in Slovyansk, where I am, even to Bakhmut. The train system still runs all the way down to downtown Bakhmut. So they can unload supplies right directly in the city where their defenders are. Mm. The other thing is things like they have a system here. It's called Nova Pochta, which is the UPS equivalent, you know, where you can get packages delivered and that kind of thing to a central location. So soldiers that need more armor plates for their bulletproof vests or night vision goggles or hearing protectors can literally go online, order them, and have them delivered right to a location in, you know, a nearby city. We were just in the Novopochta yesterday, and here are all of these army military in fatigues, AK-47s on their backs, walking up to the front desk of the Nova Pochta to pick up packages of supplies that they can have delivered right to them, which is just amazing. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. What is so unusual about this entire conflict is the combination of trench warfare with all the modern conveniences of the 21st century. So, for instance, in many of these, the centers of these towns, there's still one or two cell towers that works. So if you're in the center of a town, you might actually get cell phone coverage so that you can actually call or whatever with your smartphone, order things, that kind of thing. They've gotten all of these deliveries of SUVs. People will just donate their car and leave it at the border in Poland. So you see, the military will be driving these, something that you would see at the, you know, Factoria parking lot, that they're just driving all over the battlefield, like with cup holders. I'm laughing just because of the absurdity of it. But often these cars will be delivered with all of the things that were in them when they were owned by a family. So they'll be like little toys hanging from, you know, to keep their kids occupied. So these toys are, and here are these, you know, four big men with their AK-47 sitting in this SUV, unlike anything that I've ever seen before. That combination of modern society with really just the most kind of horrendous trench warfare that you could ever possibly imagine. You know, the rebuilding process for this country is going to be, it'll be 10 years, you know, I'll be here through all that as well, because this rebuilding process is going to take a long, long, long time.
For folks who are watching this and they know Russia came in and their military was proven to be very poorly supplied, a lot of corruption, a lot of weaknesses in the Russian military, Ukraine was able to take back much of the territory that Russia initially entered into. Now we have these seemingly stalemates around, you know, like Bakhmut. You were talking about the hot fighting that's around that city right now. Where do you see the next phase of this conflict going?
Yeah, that's a good question. If you'd asked me 2 weeks ago, I probably would have said that Bakhmut can only hold out for another couple weeks. I mean, the Russians were encircling it on three sides and were slowly closing in on the fourth side. Again, shockingly, they've left the train tracks. It's like the one area that they have not taken, that's where the train runs through. And so I would have said 2 weeks ago that they're probably going to close that loop and then just slowly move in and take that city. But the Ukrainians have had this just amazing will to fight and have pushed them back and have not allowed that closing to happen. So as a result, Bakhmut is still a fortress city. And again, on an ad hoc basis, they were not prepared for this sort of onslaught that they were going to experience from the east. So as a result, it was just people building shelters under their homes and building trenches literally with shovels and, you know, piling wood, you know, like logs on one side so that they could protect themselves from the incoming fire. In a place like Kramatorsk, twice the size of Bakhmut, they've had a full year to prepare for this. So supplies are flowing in there. I sent you photos of all of the trenches and all of the underground bunkers between Bakhmut and Kramatorsk. In order to cover that land, they're going to have to take every single one of those bunkers and overrun every single one of those trenches. And there are hundreds of them. I just don't see how it's going to be possible. So my feeling now is that Bakhmut is going to be a stalemate, that the Russians are not going to take it, that they're going to continue to supply, the Ukrainians are going to continue to supply, not just the partisans and the territorial defense forces, which are sort of the irregular army, but now the regular army is in there. So I don't see how they are going to even take Bakhmut, which has been under siege for 6-8 months, much less move any further. So I would say that at this point, if the United States can kind of provide the sort of long distance artillery that the Ukrainians need, that they could actually end up pushing the Russians out in the same way that they pushed them out of places like Kharkiv in September. I don't know if you recall, but there was this huge swath of land that was occupied by the Russians.
Yeah.
The Ukrainians had done this amazing thing where they were sort of telegraphing that, okay, we're going to do everything in Kherson. You know, we're moving troops there, we're moving material there, that kind of thing. And then they rope-a-doped them where they were like fainting with this fist and boom, they hit up on
fainted the, like to the south and then hit to the north.
Absolutely. And the Ukrainians then just completely took over. They ended up in the next 2 months taking back 53% of all of the territory that the Russians had taken to that point. They had taken back And if they could get the kind of long distance artillery that they're looking for, they could do the exact same thing in Bakhmut.
The U.S. and Europe have been hesitant about that kind of aid because they were worried about escalating the conflict. The Pentagon did announce this month, though, that it was including new arms in a military aid package that would double the range of Ukraine's rocket capabilities. That's a Boeing-made weapon called the ground-launched small-diameter bomb. What else do Ukrainians say they need right now to hold out and potentially take back more territory from Russia?
With regard to the concerns that the United States has with supplying that kind of aid, if you look at the history in this conflict of Ukraine being very careful not to bomb in the Russian territory, Ukraine has made it very clear that that is not their goal.
Hey, this is Libby. Quick note, while Ukraine has not officially claimed responsibility for attacks on Russian soil, there have been strikes on some strategic targets inside of Russia near the Ukrainian border, including drone attacks on a Russian military airbase and oil depots. Okay, back to the interview.
All they're trying to do is basically push the Russians back out of their territory and move back to the 1991 borders. It's been very clear. Ukraine is completely the victim of this aggression. I think that the concern on the West's part with regard to supplying that kind of aid is misplaced. And it would actually end up moving things back to the way things were pre-2014, which is when this war really started.
Yeah. What I hear you saying is Ukrainians, in order to feel that they have a victory here, they're going to want to take back the territory that Russia did take in 2014. This is not a situation where they're going to be happy with returning to those borders.
That's absolutely right. And basically, at this point, if the West or Ukraine were to say, all right, let's just go back to the way things were pre-February 24th,
yeah,
then you're rewarding Russia for having taken that land. You're only encouraging this thing to happen again. I mean, if we don't allow the Ukrainians to take back their original borders, then you're basically saying that if you fight long enough and you make things difficult enough for us, we're going to give up.
What about if Ukraine gets expedited entry into the EU? And so there is an advancement in terms of aligning itself with Europe, but there is an acceptance that their country and their infrastructure is going to continue to be destroyed by Russia, and the Russian troops are not going to leave that area. Is there a sense that eventually there could be some kind of an acceptance of it's not right, but in order to preserve the country that we had in 2014, at least, we're going to have to accept something short of retaking all of that territory? Again, something like joining the EU. I mean, could that be seen as advancement in the eyes of Ukrainians?
It would definitely be seen as advancement. And it is certainly something that Ukraine has been pushing for. They would love to be part of the EU. I think that they've been very clear since the very beginning that this is not a question of February 24th. This is a question of 2014, when the Donbas and Crimea were taken originally. And the argument is that if the West had taken action then, we would not be in the situation that we're in now. And settling for some sort of compromise would end up only encouraging Russia to continue to be aggressive, to continue to take more land.
I was listening to an interview with the 35-year-old editor of Ukrainska Pravda, who was speaking with The New Yorker about the war and her generation and how she's feeling. And again, she's 35. She's a millennial and was born in the Soviet Union, but grew up in a free Ukraine. And she said that she feels that her generation is fighting the ghost of the Soviet Union.
I do believe that this is kind of an appointment for my generation that was born in Soviet Empire, and I was born in Soviet Union. And we have to destroy this Soviet Empire and like the ghost of the Soviet Empire. And this is a goal of our generation.
Do you think that reflects the resolve that the Ukrainian people are feeling at this point, a year into a very brutal war in which they've seen heavy losses?
Yeah, no question. This is a war being fought by millennials. This is a generation in their 20s and 30s. So a year ago, the majority of the people that are fighting this war, because the Ukrainian military was, it was large, you know, it was pretty big, but not the size that it is now by any stretch. So it was like, okay, we need to beef up. So we'll, people need to start in militias, you know, basically manning the trenches, you know, in the first days of the war, then moving into the territorial defense forces, which is like an irregular army. And then many of those people then moved into the actual Ukrainian army. So there's this, been this progression. But the majority of the people doing that are all in their 20s and 30s. So they were doing things like they were baristas or web page designers a year ago. In downtown Lviv or downtown Kyiv, it would have looked like downtown Berlin, you know, or downtown Vienna. So the way that that generation has stepped up to fight this war is really inspiring.
They had no question that this was a free and independent Ukraine. I mean, they had no memory, really, of living under Soviet rule. And so the idea that Putin would come in and try to put the band back together and, you know, retake Ukraine, that makes no sense to them.
Absolutely not. And, you know, putting the band back together, that's a great way to put it, because that's exactly what he thought was going to happen. He and you probably read some of the analyses that I have, which is, you know, how could this have even happened? How could this have even started? How could anyone have deluded themselves into thinking that the Ukrainians actually wanted to be back in the Soviet Union? This generation had nothing to do with the Soviet Union. And for that editor to be talking about the ghosts of, she's right. That's all it is. It's vapor. You know, that idea is something that has motivated Vladimir Putin and his cadre, but it had no sense of reality here in Ukraine. And the idea of these millennials who, again, you could be in downtown Berlin, going back to that sort of lifestyle, completely foreign. What they're fighting for now is a return to the life that they had before, the normality of just being basically part of the West. You know, they weren't in the EU yet, but they were applying, and they would have, they've made huge strides. You know, corruption is a big issue, but they have really fought to reduce the amount of corruption, all that kind of thing. So they were definitely on a path. And, you know, to Vladimir Putin's chagrin, I'm sure that has been speeded up. So yeah, within 5 years, they could be part of the EU. And that is what this generation is fighting for. And I don't think that Vladimir Putin had any idea what he was, it's very clear. He had no idea what he was getting into when he started this war. And a lot of those trenches between Bakhmut and Kramatorsk are manned by these very people. These very millennials are in those trenches right now fighting for return to the life that they had before, which was definitely a European life and definitely a life in the EU.
Pivoting to a slightly lighter topic, I know you have your search and rescue dog Libby there, my namesake, or perhaps I'm her namesake. How has Libby been providing support and comfort there in Ukraine? What's Libby been up to?
She's great. In fact, Libby, come here.
Libby.
She's sort of the mascot for the team.
Come on, Libby, come on. Come on.
I can hear her walking around.
Libby, come.
Here she comes. She's a lab, so she's a big goofball.
Hey, Libby. Oh, she's a sweetheart. She's giving you kisses.
Oh, boy. She has been great. This is why she is the mascot for the team, is because she is like the friendliest dog you would ever possibly imagine. She's a full-on FEMA search dog. I got permission from FEMA to bring her with me here. One of the things that we're in the process of doing is setting up a training program for Ukrainian EMS workers to train dogs to be search and rescue dogs. So this is urban search. So this is collapsed buildings and that kind of thing. That need is huge. And the idea that we could train 20 or 30 dogs to do that sort of thing They sent a search and rescue team from Ukraine, you know, given that they're in the middle of a war and certainly need all of those resources for their own collapsed buildings, that kind of thing. They sent a whole team to Turkey after the earthquake there.
Wow.
So that was 30 or 40 search and rescue people and four or five dogs that all went to Turkey to do search and rescue there. So the idea of getting, you know, more search dogs, more urban search, more buildings are getting hit by missiles, more buildings are being collapsed by artillery. The need is huge. So my pitch to FEMA was basically, if we can set up a program here in Ukraine to train search dogs here in Ukraine, Ukrainian dogs, Ukrainian EMS personnel, that would be a win for the whole world, not just, you know, Ukraine. So that was my pitch. They thought it was a great idea. And so they allowed me to, you know, she's a FEMA asset. So it's not like I could just, you know, like check out a chainsaw and take it to Ukraine, which is basically what I was asking. They thought it was a great idea. And so I'm in the process of doing that. So that's kind of like my secondary project, is to set up that search and rescue program for dogs.
Well, David, thank you so much. You and Libby for joining me today. And especially as we reflect on this year anniversary of the war and everything the Ukrainian people are going through, I really appreciate your perspective and your time, which is very precious there. Thank you.
My pleasure to do it. And thank you for the interest, and continue to support Ukraine. They need all the help that they can get. So the more help that they can get, the faster this war is going to be over.
David Tagliani is a volunteer with the Ukrainian aid organization Stay Safe UA. He sent us some photos of his work that we'll be sharing on KUOW.org. And you can find out more about Stay Safe UA at staysafeua.org. Thanks for listening to Soundside. Don't forget you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime right here online at KUOW.org, or, of course, on your favorite podcast app.